You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. On the podcast, coming up, a dive into some of the universe's most perplexing scientific mysteries. Particle physicist Harry Cliff is here to discuss his book, Space Oddities. Harry's day job is as a physicist at the University of Cambridge. He's joined in conversation for this episode by Alex Wilkins, reporter for The New Scientist. Let's join Alex now with more.
My guest on the podcast today is Harry Cliff, a physicist, author, and sometime comedian whose new book asserts that there's something very strange going on in the cosmos. It's called Space Oddities. David Bowie's lawyers have not yet been in touch, but the book contains a similar wide-eyed sense of magic, awe and wonder at what's going on all around us that hopefully the late artist might approve of. Harry is focusing on a catalogue of quite frankly weird phenomena that at the present moment just can't be explained and that challenges our long-established understandings of how the universe works. Why are stars flying away from us faster than anyone can explain? What are the source of mysterious particles found to hold huge amounts of energy trapped beneath Antarctic ice? And what really goes on at the CERN Large Hadron Collider, a place where Harry does quite a bit of his work? He joins me now to talk about it all. Harry, welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much for joining us. So that was my intro for you, but it might help listeners for you to explain what your background is and why you're a better person than most to explain this world of space oddities.
So I'm a particle physicist, so that means I study basically the most fundamental building blocks of the universe that we've found so far. And I do that at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, which is this gigantic 27-kilometer particle accelerator buried about 100 meters under the Swiss-French countryside. And I'm part of a big international team. There's about 1,400 of us, physicists, computer scientists, engineers. And basically what we are interested in are these particles called beauty quarks, which are exotic fundamental particles that don't exist in the universe normally, but we make them in very large numbers at the LHC and then study their properties. And the reason these things are interesting is that the way they behave, the way they decay, for example, because they're unstable, they only live for a very short period of time before they turn into other stuff, can tell us about ingredients of the universe that we've not found so far. So that's sort of my background. But in terms of where the idea for the book came, I mean, the book is really about anomalies. So these sort of things you see in nature, be that in experiments here on Earth or looking at the universe at the biggest scales, which don't line up with our current theoretical understanding of how the universe works. And on my experiment, we've been seeing a series of anomalies over the last decade. So my career really for the last few years has been trying to figure out, you know, are these things really the clue to some major breakthrough, or are they a red herring that's like leading us down the garden path, to mix metaphors? So that's really where the interest in the book came from. But actually, if you look around physics and cosmology more broadly, the subject has been dominated by anomalies in many different areas that are coming from different sorts of experiments and different sorts of observations. So it's a really interesting topic that potentially is telling us something big about the way that our understanding of the universe might evolve in the next few years.
Well, I agree. It was fascinating reading about the breadth of anomalies that go on in physics, as you say, from everything from cosmology to particle physics. And unless you're a working scientist at the forefront of your field, I think you're really unlikely to feel as close to the science as you get in this book. One thing that really came across was, at least in particle physics, there are some moments of real drama. It's quite away from the picture some people have of science as this long, laborious process. I was wondering if you could just set the scene for listeners about how some of these moments of high drama come about, especially in the particle physics world.
Yeah, I mean, well, it definitely is this long, laborious process, but then quite often it culminates in this moment of drama. So yeah, there's a little vignette that I open the book with, which is a description. I mean, it doesn't sound that exciting, but it's a description of a Zoom meeting between some of my colleagues. So this is during the sort of middle of lockdown 2021. And basically, they've come to the end of this very long process of analyzing the latest data that we've recorded in the experiment. And what they're looking at is a particular anomaly that, if it gets borne out, would prove the existence of a new fundamental force, which would be a massive deal. So what they've been doing for the last years is really this painstaking process of really trying to understand the experiment, understand their analysis methods, try and find all the hidden biases that could mess them up. And then at the very end, there is this real moment of reveal where one of the this practice has become very common in physics and cosmology is this process called blinding, which basically is that you do not allow yourself to look at the final result of your measurement until you've basically agreed exactly how you're going to analyze the data, have everything sort of set up. Basically, you've almost written the paper and all that's left is to fill in the result at the end. And that's designed to prevent you from either consciously or unconsciously massaging your techniques to kind of move the result one direction or another. And when the stakes are as big as, you know, we might discover a new force, you really, really have to be sure that you're not biasing yourself. But then there is this moment where everything's agreed, everything's finished, and there was this moment where my colleagues basically unscrambled the result for the very first time, and they saw collectively on their screens that this anomaly had been confirmed, it had grown in significance. And so this was like a really kind of exciting moment, and I suppose a moment of like catharsis and climax after like what is a really long period of hard work where they were working, you know, very long hours. So yeah, you science isn't a sort of dramatic. It's dramatic at these certain moments. A lot of it is like hard slog. And then you get these moments of payoff very occasionally where you see that you may have actually discovered something new, which as a scientist is the most exciting thing that can happen in your career.
Absolutely. And you have this really nice quote actually from sci-fi writer Isaac Asimov, where he talks about the process of science that rather than having these eureka moments that people know very well, it more starts with a, that's interesting. What would you say the kind of balance is in your scientific career of eureka moments where you've thought, oh yeah, I've got it, that makes sense, and kind of a, that seems unusual?
I mean, to be honest, in my career, I think these moments where you really make a discovery are so rare. And I've probably had this, you know, once basically in the 10 years or so that I've been in the field, which is actually a similar related to this anomaly that I was talking about. I was making my own set of measurements to try to sort of get some extra evidence about what might be going on with a PhD student at Cambridge. And we had our similar moment of unblinding in the summer of 2021. So a little bit after this like initial moment of excitement that caused actually that result that I was talking about before got into the international press. So it was genuinely this really exciting moment that broke out from, you know, the walls of particle physics out into the wider world. And so we had our own moment of, you know, reveal where we basically saw our measurements again lined up with the evidence that was accumulating from our colleagues. So that was, you know, that was a dramatic moment. But most of the time, I mean, actually what has happened in my career, and I think it's true generally in particle physics, is most of the time when you get a result, it confirms the theory that we already have, because we have this theory called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which is, well, it's a really boring name for what is probably the most impressive intellectual achievement of humankind. It's this incredibly elegant and accurate description of the fundamental physics that, you know, gives rise to the world around us. And it's so successful that it's actually kind of annoyingly successful, in a sense that like what we're really trying to find are places where this theory breaks down, because we know that it can't be the final word on fundamental physics for various reasons. Like, you know, it doesn't say anything about what dark matter or dark energy are, these substances that dominate the universe according to astronomy. So we believe there must be something else out there. But essentially the story of, you know, the LHC and a lot of particle physics in the last decade has been confirming the predictions of the Standard Model. And it's only very, very occasionally that you see something that looks like it might be evidence of the Standard Model breaking down. So yeah, these moments are really hard fought. Most of the time, what happens is, you know, you do your measurement and you go, oh yeah, that agrees with the Standard Model. That checks out. So there's nothing new to see here.
Definitely. I think people might be familiar in general with the scientific method from maybe their school or university careers. But one thing that really came across in the book is that anomalies are central to this process and have been central for hundreds of years. There was a really nice passage in the book where you talk about the planet Vulcan, or the proposed planet Vulcan. What was that about, and how did the kind of strange anomaly turn out to prove a really earth-shaking discovery for science?
Yeah, I mean, the story of Vulcan is really fun. Basically, in the 19th century, there was this problem with the orbit of Mercury where Mercury kept embarrassing astronomers, basically. They would try and observe its transits across the sun. So when you see this little dark dot of the planet as it goes across the face of the sun, and they kept missing its transits by like hours, I think in one case by a whole day. And this caused a lot of puzzlement, because In the 19th century, the universe was thought to run like a clockwork mechanism according to Newton's laws of motion and particularly Newton's law of gravity. So you ought to be able to predict the orbits of the planets. And so a planet with poor timekeeping was really quite disturbing. And there had been a similar problem with the orbit of the planet Uranus that had been solved by a very eminent French astronomer called Urbain Le Verrier. And essentially what Le Verrier had hypothesized was that there was an unseen eighth planet that was pulling on Uranus, and its gravitational tug was altering its orbit slightly, which meant it didn't agree with the predictions of Newton's theory. And when he told astronomers essentially where to look in the sky, they pointed their telescopes, they discovered the planet Neptune. So this is something that already happened and been successful. So when, you know, this problem with the orbit of Mercury was found, Le Verrier made the same sort of attempt to solve the problem. He said, well, perhaps there is a planet inside the orbit of Mercury, between Mercury and the Sun. And then there was this extraordinary event where a rural French doctor called Edmond Lescarbot read an article by Le Verrier about his predicted new planet. And he remembered something that he'd seen. He's an amateur astronomer. And earlier that year, he'd seen this dark dot crossing the sun, which didn't, you know, match any known objects in the sky. And so he wrote to Le Verrier and said, I saw this weird thing. Maybe it's your planet. And Le Verrier comes down to his house in rural France, like bursts into his hallway, interrogates him, inspects his astronomical equipment, and basically concludes after all of this that this rural doctor, amateur astronomer, has discovered this planet, which he announces to the world a few days later as the planet Vulcan. And this causes massive international media sensation. Lescarbot, the doctor, is rewarded with the Légion d'honneur, so the sort of France's highest honor. Le Verrier is praised as having predicted yet another planet. But, you know, you probably haven't heard of the planet Vulcan, and that's because over the course of the next few decades, astronomers kept trying to find the planet again, and it wouldn't show up where Le Verrier predicted. And by the early years of the 20th century, astronomers basically concluded that this thing did not, in fact, exist. And, whatever Lescarbot had seen, it wasn't a planet. Maybe it was a sunspot or something else. But the anomaly in Mercury's orbit nonetheless remained. So Mercury still wasn't behaving as expected. That needed to be solved. And the solution was actually far more revolutionary than just a new planet. The ultimate solution came from Albert Einstein in 1915, just as he was putting the finishing touches to what would be his masterpiece, which is this new theory of gravity and space-time called general relativity. And as Einstein was completing his theory, the first thing he did was to use it to calculate the orbit of Mercury. And to his delight, and I think also kind of it was almost overwhelmed by it, he found that his theory accurately predicted this anomaly in the orbit of Mercury. And he was so overwhelmed by this, he had heart palpitations, had to have a lie down. So basically, you know, this anomaly was tiny. It was like a 1 in 12 million anomaly. So basically, Mercury was making an extra orbit of the sun every 12 million orbits. So it was a really small effect. But in that little tiny effect was the clue to this revolutionary new theory of the universe, which led to the Big Bang theory, black holes, gravitational waves, so much of what we take for granted now in cosmology. So that is the power of anomalies in science. You know, sometimes they are this clue to some really profound new way of understanding the world.
No, it's an amazing example of how the whole process works. Just to shift to the present, I'd say an equally exciting passage, at least in the way that you wrote it, was this effort that you were involved with and other groups that showed this potentially strange result that could challenge the standard model of particle physics. I do want to ask you what it was like to be a part of that, but I was wondering if you could just kind of explain to our audience exactly what you were trying to measure and why the stakes were so high and why the ramifications were potentially so large.
Yeah, so, I mean, these anomalies basically came from these beauty quarks, these fundamental particles that we study at the LHCb experiment where I work. And what we've been seeing a few different things, but basically, what we've been looking at are very rare decays. So when you create a beauty quark in a collision at the LHC, it lives for about 1.5 trillionths of a second. It will fly a little distance in your detector, like a few millimeters, and then it will decay into other particles. And it can decay in hundreds of different ways to all kinds of different standard model particles. But there are decays that are extremely rare in the standard model. So these are things that happen like 1 in a million times. So if you have 1 million beauty quarks, one of them will decay in this way. And there's a particular decay where a beauty quark turns into a strange quark and also either a muon and an anti-muon. or an electron and an anti-electron. So there's a lot of like terminology flying around. A muon is essentially a heavy version of the electron. So you have these particles, electrons, and muons. They're basically the same, but the muon is about 200 times heavier than an electron. And in the standard model, the forces in the standard model treat electrons and muons exactly the same. So that means if you have a beauty quark that decays into electrons and or into muons, those two decays should happen at the same rate, basically, because the decays happen through the forces that exist in the standard model. And what we've been seeing for many years was that the electron decay was happening more often than the muon decay. And this is basically impossible to explain in our current understanding of particle physics. So it suggested, if it was a real effect, the existence of a new force. And more than that, the thing that was really exciting is that there is this mystery, a fundamental mystery of the standard model of particle physics. There are these, what we call generations of particles. So we are made basically of three fundamental particles, the electron, the up quark, and the down quark. And they are part of a quartet of particles called the first generation of matter. Now, for reasons we do not understand, there exist two other generations that are heavier. So the muon is the second generation version of the electron. The beauty quark is actually the third generation version of the down quark. And we do not understand why these generations exist. And we don't really either understand why is there an electron and two quarks? You know, we don't have an explanation. We sort of see these things in nature and we kind of put them in, essentially, a bit like, you know, a zoologist collecting species of butterfly or something. And what we really like to understand is, you know, what is the deeper reason for the existence of these fundamental building blocks of the universe? And so a force that treats electrons and muons differently is likely to be connected to the reason these things exist in the first place, or how they come into existence. So that's why it sort of is not just another force, which in itself would be very cool, but it's potentially telling you something deep about the structure of reality, essentially, at the very deepest levels. So that's why the stakes are enormous. And as I said, so this vignette I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast, you know, where they unblinded this result, that was essentially an anomaly that was confirmed this effect. My own work appeared to confirm it, but what happened in the end, I mean, this sort of shows you how science works, is that about a year after these results were published and they caused this big media sensation, we discovered a hidden or missed bias in the results. Effectively, what had happened were there were beauty quark decays to different types of particles, essentially particles called hadrons, which are particles made of quarks, essentially, that were sort of masquerading as electrons. So we were counting things that weren't electrons as electrons, and that created the illusion of an anomaly. And when we fixed this, basically when we discovered this problem, it was a real moment of horror, because, you know, as an experimental physicist, the thing you know you're desperate to get right is, you know, you're trying to measure nature, you want to make sure you're measuring in an unbiased way. And once we corrected this mistake, the anomalies, this set of anomalies disappeared. So it was a real sort of like roller coaster of, you know, lots of hard work, you think you've made a big discovery, and then it all kind of unravels. And that's a story I wanted to tell in the book, because I think it's kind of important to see, you know, that's how science works. But it's not quite, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, actually, because that was one set of anomalies to do with these processes. But there are others to do with the angles the particles come out at or don't agree with the standard model, and the rates these things are happening at also don't agree. So there's still something to be understood here, whether it's, you know, really new physics, either something new fundamentally, or whether it's something else, something more mundane, we don't yet know. So yeah, that was a sort of, that was actually happening as I was writing the book as well. So it was a kind of interesting emotional journey, kind of cataloging this as while I was living through this whole process. But one of the things that came away from it, realizing, I suppose, is that one of the things that makes anomalies, I think, so interesting is that, yes, sometimes, very, very occasionally, they are the clue to a deeper understanding of something really fundamental, you know, like general relativity or a new force. But even when they're not, the process of understanding them, so figuring out what's the mundane explanation for this, teaches you something, and quite often teaches you something quite deep about ordinary physics that we already know about. So, you know, whether that's to do with the way you detect particles in experiment, or our theory of quarks and gluons, or, you know, how to measure distances in space. There's all these sorts of, essentially by trying to understand these anomalies, you're basically sharpening your scientific tools, which means that when you come to the next anomaly or the next measurement or the next observation, you're better prepared to make a discovery. So they're kind of laying the groundwork for the next step in science.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yeah, as you say, it seems a really important part of the whole scientific process. Just to ask you about your like personal feelings, as you said, it was a roller coaster. There were points of joy and ecstasy, and then points of, as you say, horror. How did you personally feel through the whole thing? Did you feel like you were surfing those points as well on the roller coaster, or were you able to kind of take a step back from it all?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely highs and lows. I mean, there was a point, it was October 2021, where I went out to CERN to give a seminar about the results that me and my student had, John Smeaton, had come up with at Cambridge. And that was, you know, that was just after COVID. It was sort of the first big meeting since lockdown. And it was really, you know, after that event, being sitting around having some beers in the CERN cafeteria with colleagues, and the sort of sense from what everyone else was saying and their excitement that you'd actually, you know, done something that moved the dial. That was a kind of really, you know, exciting moment. But then, you know, as you say, as we gradually realized the following year that there was something wrong with our measurements, that really was a pretty, you know, difficult period. Cause you, first of all, you just feel, you know, I suppose extremely anxious at first about the fact there might be a mistake, and then gradually, you know, this increasing sense of horror when you realize there is a mistake. And then there's obviously a lot of work to be done to figure out exactly what's gone wrong, because this effect is, the effect that we missed was extremely subtle. And the only reason it was discovered actually was because another team within the experiment were repeating some of our measurements, and they used slightly different techniques, and their technique gave a different answer to the one that had been published that was only a little bit different. But people would thought, well, that's a bit weird. And basically it was the process of drilling into that we discovered it. We could easily have missed it if, you know, and it might still be out there. These things would get found out eventually. They always do, ultimately, because other experiments would try to measure them and they wouldn't see the same thing. But it was very, in some ways, fortunate that we discovered it actually when we did. But yeah, that was pretty tough. And I think, you know, you did for a while feel quite, I definitely felt a little bit depressed for a while, because you kind of, you're in science because you want to make a discoveries, and then sort of there's this great sense of excitement when you think, okay, we're on the brink of something big, where if this is real, then there's going to be this whole new set of measurements and this adventure we're going to go on and understanding what's going on with these anomalies. And I suppose the feeling that seeing that crumble away was pretty difficult at times, but after a while, you know, you kind of become a bit more philosophical about it. And I think it's really good training. You know, I think you know, caution and skepticism are two of the most important qualities in a scientist. And I think I'm definitely more cautious and skeptical than I was before as a result of this, which will hopefully make me a better scientist in the future. One of the things I mentioned in the book, I remember as a student, one of my tutors at university had this little card that was stuck above his desk with a quote on it that said, "I've learned so much from my mistakes, I think I'll make another." And I think that's true. Like, mistakes are basically, you know, some of the best ways of learning, essentially. So I think we all learn a huge amount from this process. And as I said, the story's not over, right? There are other anomalies that are still there that still need to be investigated. And, you know, whether or not their new physics is up for grabs, but there's still some work to be done there to figure out exactly what's going on.
Absolutely. And one more quality that maybe you didn't mention there, but something that actually really came through in the book was resilience. There was a really touching bit where towards the end of the chapter where you're describing that whole process, you're speaking with one of the scientists involved, and he kind of said, like you, that he was depressed for a bit, but then he took a step back and realized that this was part of the scientific process and it's what makes the whole thing work. So I wanted to ask, how important do you think is resilience for a scientist and being able to put everything into context and not kind of put all your eggs in the basket of one result?
Yeah, I think resilience is incredibly important. And I suppose also, you know, perseverance, determination, not just in, you know, our set of results. I mean, you know, some of the stories in the book, one of the things that you kind of, I think, comes across is the lengths that people will go to add a little bit more understanding to our body of knowledge. I mean, an example of this, there's this another anomaly in the book that I talk about, which is an anomaly to do with these particles called muons, where, you know, a team of people dedicated, you know, two decades of their lives essentially to, you know, they end up moving this massive magnetic ring from New York to Chicago across a continent, assembling this incredible experiment, analyzing data, getting, you know, raising the money to, and this was all basically to measure a number, the magnetism of the muon, how magnetic these particles are, to an extra decimal place, basically. You know, so people really, you know, they go to extreme lengths to sort of crank out this like little bit of extra precision in the hope that you're going to see something new. So I think there's something kind of extraordinary about that. And, you know, with absolutely no guarantee that it's going to lead anywhere necessarily. I mean, all you may end up with at the end of it is a more precise measurement that agrees with the standard model, and you won't have discovered something. And that is the most likely outcome. So I think you have to be sort of determined and resilient, but you also, I suppose, you have to maintain a sense of optimism, because if you lose that, then, you know, you may as well go home, I think. So you have to sort of be simultaneously skeptical and cautious, but also optimistic that eventually one of these measurements is going to give us the clue we need to make a major breakthrough.
Yeah, it seems like a really delicate kind of tightrope that you have to walk in, balancing all of these different qualities and attributes. There was one saga in the book that is maybe a slightly more unresolved stage than the work that you were in. I mean, hopefully not, but... And this is to do with the Hubble tension, which we can see there's results coming out every year. I mean, for people who are closely following it, there's been some really interesting results in the past week. I know the Hubble tension and cosmology isn't your exact area of expertise, but you write about it beautifully in the book. And I was wondering if you could just explain what this tension is in simple terms to readers.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the big anomaly in cosmology at the moment. It's basically a disagreement over how fast the universe is expanding. So, you know, the universe has been expanding since the Big Bang, and we have two different ways of getting at the rate of expansion. One of them is essentially to look out into space at things we can see in the night sky, so distant galaxies. And what you do is you measure how far away a galaxy is, and then you measure how fast it's moving. And doing that is not trivial. It's quite difficult, particularly the distance bit. Measuring the distance to a galaxy is very hard. But if you do that to enough galaxies, what you can then do is plot the speed that they're receding from us versus distance, and that gives you a measure of the expansion rate, technically something called the Hubble constant, which basically relates the distance a galaxy is from us to how fast it's moving away from us, or appears to be moving away from us. So that's one way. The other way is to study the faded light from the Big Bang, this radiation that is a, you know, covers the entire night sky called the cosmic microwave background. And by looking at subtle fluctuations in this radiation, you can determine the properties of the early universe. So, you know, the relative amounts of dark energy, dark matter, radiation, ordinary matter, and so on. And then you plug all of that into the standard cosmological model, this theory of the universe and its history, and you can run the clock forwards from essentially a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang to today, and you can predict what the expansion rate should be based on the early universe. So if your measurements are right, and if your cosmological model that takes you from the early universe to today is right, these two ways of getting at the expansion rate should agree, and they don't at the moment. And they haven't agreed for quite some time. So this anomaly's been around since about 2013 in some form. And there are, you know, several possible explanations. The most popular mundane explanation has been that we don't know how to measure distances to galaxies properly. And this is a very difficult thing to do. Basically, it's kind of like, it's captured by this famous scene in Father Ted where, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Ted and Dougal, who are these two priests, Ted is trying to explain to his half-witted fellow priest the concept of perspective. And they're sitting in this caravan and he's pointing out the window at some cows in a field. And he says, and he's got some little model cows in his hands. He says, "These ones are small, Dougal, but the ones out there are far away." And we have basically the same problem in astronomy, where if you look at a galaxy, you don't really know if it's a big galaxy that's far away or a small galaxy that's close to you. And so there are lots of very clever techniques for getting at distances using these pulsating stars called Cepheids or using supernovae. But calibrating these things is very hard. There's lots of details in the way you do this that could lead to potential mistakes. So that has been the bit of the puzzle that people have really focused on. You know, what's called the cosmic distance ladder, the methods we use to measure distances in the universe, is that solid? Is there a mistake in it potentially somewhere? You know, maybe it's a mistake in the cosmic microwave background measurements, but that seems unlikely. Those seem very solid. So the other possibility, the exciting one, is that the theory that we use to go from the early universe to today is missing something. So there's something missing from our standard cosmological model. And that is the kind of exciting possibility that people are increasingly, I think, coming around to the idea that this may actually be the real deal. But actually, as we speak, there is a meeting in London at the Royal Society that's been going on this week, where one of the sort of dramas of this story is that you have two sort of leading astronomers, a guy called Adam Riess, who's a Nobel Prize winner. He won the Nobel Prize for the co-discovery of the accelerating universe, so the discovery of dark energy back in the late 90s. And then another very eminent astronomer called Wendy Friedman, who led the first sort of precise measurements of the expansion rate of the universe using the Hubble Space Telescope in the 1990s. There's these two like titans essentially of cosmology, and Adam Riess, it's his team that have been measuring this fast expansion rate compared to the prediction. Wendy Friedman is, I think it's fair to say, pretty skeptical about the anomaly and has her own set of measurements. And she, I think just this week, produced a new measurement of the expansion rate using James Webb Space Telescope data that lines up better with the prediction from the early universe. It doesn't quite line up with it perfectly, but it's closer to it. And this has been quite a sort of, I'd say, enthusiastic debate, maybe to put it politely, between these two, you know, two astronomers. And it's not clear where it's going to go. So, you know, what people have been really looking forward to is James Webb, because one of the sort of potential places where there's a problem in this measurement is in these pulsating stars called Cepheids. So these are stars that grow brighter and dimmer over time, and they can be used as a standard candle for calibrating distances in the universe. But the problem with Cepheids is that because they're young, large stars, they tend to be found in the dust lanes of galaxies. So there's a potential for the observations of Cepheids to be blocked out by dust. But because James Webb looks at the universe in infrared, it can see through the dust and allow us to sort of check whether our Cepheid measurements are correct. Adam Riess produced a paper, I think last October, using James Webb to study the Cepheids, and found that it lined up perfectly with the previous measurements he'd made, whereas Wendy Friedman's got her own set of measurements, it seems, that don't. So, I mean, as to where this is going, I'm not a cosmologist, so I'm not really qualified to say, but it's certainly very interesting. And I think of all of the anomalies in the book, that is the one that I think may well be telling us something genuinely new about the universe beyond just the fact that it's hard to measure distances, i.e. there may be forms of energy or forms of dark matter in the universe that we are hitherto not been aware of, and they may be required to explain what we're seeing.
I agree. It's a really fascinating tension. And actually, that meant that meeting that you mentioned at the Royal Society, I was actually there earlier today and I was speaking to cosmologists and astrophysicists and about Wendy Friedman's presentation, and everyone seemed very excited at the new data they were getting from JWST and what this might tell us about the future Hubble tension results. I like that you kind of put this battle, or maybe battle's not correct, but an argument between Friedman and Rees in terms of their two different measurements. And I thought it was interesting how in scientific history you often get prominent physicists who have very different opinions, like Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr, over whether quantum mechanics is random and probabilistic, and Einstein saying God doesn't play dice and things like that. And with the way that modern science is done, in having very large research groups and having lots of people working in a collaborative way, how homogenous would you say is the opinions within any one group? Like, if you're working within a team at CERN or with these collaborations to measure the Hubble constant, do you have to kind of conform to what the opinion of the group is, or is there lots of differences of opinion within the group and kind of infighting? What does it look like from the inside?
I think it's it depends a lot on what people are working on specifically. So even within these big collaborations, you know, at the LHC, say, where you have 1,000 or more scientists, everyone's working on different stuff. So they're looking at the data in different ways. They're studying different sorts of processes. So, you know, back when the anomalies at LHCb were, you know, looking very promising, there was certainly a core of people who were working in that area who were, I think, broadly pretty convinced by them. And that was supported by theoretical physicists outside the experiment who had analyzed these anomalies together, because there was a whole bunch of them, and found that you could come up with a consistent explanation. So if you spoke to the theorists, and particularly people working in the area, they were pretty excited and bullish. If you spoke to people who worked on a slightly different area of physics, they'd be like more skeptical. And particularly if you went to another experiment at the LHC, Atlas and CMS, you know, that I think you'd encounter more skepticism the further away you got, essentially, from the measurement itself. So I think it really depends, you know, how much skin you have in the game, how much experience you have of the particular area. But it's I think in some sense, you know, within these big collaborations, you obviously have differences of opinion, you know, but it's usually differences of opinion over, you know, what's precisely the right way to make this measurement, or how do we publish this result? How do we describe it? It's rarely about, you know, is this real or not? Because ultimately, as an experimental physicist, it's not really up to us to say if something's real. Our job is to publish the results as best we can and say, this is what we see. And it's for others to, you know, interpret those largely. So it's, you know, I think that helps. I suppose if you talk to theoretical physicists in particle physics, that's where you may have, you know, different ideas about ways to approach things, and you perhaps get more, because they tend to work in smaller teams or more independently, you get people with stronger points of view that may have more disagreements. But within a big collaboration, it's more about, you know, exactly how do we make this measurement? And that can still lead to some arguments and disagreements. People have their opinions, but ultimately, you know, nature decides what's right.
Absolutely. But we've heard from some quarters, from both scientists and kind of more distant observers, that all the big discoveries have kind of been found, and that all the new experiments are maybe barking up the wrong tree, or we're not finding big new physics. I know particle physicists often get accused of being at a dead end, and I know CERN and the LHC gets a lot of criticism. But in your book, you really argue quite strongly that there's loads of exciting stuff happening right now, and that we have lots to be optimistic about. Do you think we're reaching a dead end in science or particle physics, or how enthusiastic should we be about the future?
No, I mean, it wouldn't surprise you to say I don't think we're reaching a dead end. I think, you know, what we have found is that it's hard, it's unsurprising perhaps, but it's hard to make new discoveries. And people who say, you know, oh, you're wasting your time, it's very easy to sit outside the field and say that. But I mean, you know, if you accept that way of thinking, well, okay, fine, we'll just give up on trying to understand the universe. Basically, what we're trying to do at the LHC, and not just at the LHC, but in particle physics broadly, is come up with a really broad range of strategies to give us the best possibility of finding something new. And we have really good reasons, you know, for compelling reasons for thinking there is new stuff out there. Now, whether we find it at the LHC or whether we find it at some other experiment, we don't yet know. But if we don't make these measurements, particularly measuring the standard model itself. So we have this theory that works incredibly well. And one of the great legacies of the LHC, whether or not we find new physics, is a much more detailed understanding of the standard model. And this is a fundamental theory of our universe. So that is a hugely important scientific, you know, kind of project that I think maybe is underappreciated. For example, you know, the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012, some people were quite blasé about it because, oh, it had been predicted before. But this, the Higgs, is genuinely new physics. I mean, it's unlike anything we've seen before. And one of the big projects for my colleagues at Atlas and CMS in the next decade is really understanding as much as we can about the Higgs boson before the LHC switches off. And that will leave us a legacy of knowledge whether or not we find new physics. But basically, you know, when you're on the frontier of science and you're trying to make new discoveries, you really are, to some extent, scrabbling around in the dark. You know, you really don't know where the new discoveries may lie. So you have to be broad-based and try to kind of have a strategy that covers as much of the new terrain as you can. And hopefully you keep doing that. You will eventually, I think, something will show up eventually, because we know there must be something new out there. I think it's extremely unlikely that this is the end of the road in terms of our fundamental understanding of the universe, because we have these massive mysteries to solve, like dark matter and dark energy. The fact that the universe exists in the form that it does is very puzzling as well, and many, many more besides. So I'm optimistic that, you know, as if we keep hammering away at nature, eventually we will find the clue that leads us to the next level of understanding.
I really like that outlook, and I think it's quite inspirational, hopefully, for people listening who maybe want to be scientists or working scientists. I think having the prospect of finding new things and discoveries is really a powerful driving force. I just wanted to ask, while I have you, do you have a favorite anomaly or space oddity, past or present? I know you might be biased to kind of ones you've worked on, but what would you say your favorite anomaly is?
I don't know about a favorite one, but I mean, the one that actually I start the book with, which is just a kind of cool one for the actual story behind it, which is this anomaly that was discovered by this team who launched a radio antenna attached to a massive NASA helium balloon into the sky above Antarctica. There's an instrument called ANITA. And basically what they found were evidence of very, very high energy cosmic rays coming out of the Antarctic ice, so like emerging from within the Earth. And they saw two of these things, just two of them. But they're very hard to explain, because there's no particle that we know about that could travel all the way through thousands of kilometers of rock and emerge into the atmosphere from within the Earth. And it's just a cool story, because, you know, the potential explanations for these particles are very exciting. But that aside, just the environment that these scientists are working in, out there at McMurdo Station on the edge of the Antarctic continent, working in, you know, freezing conditions in this kind of really dramatic landscape, where you're having to kind of go out to this balloon station on a specially designed bus with these gigantic tires down snow roads, working in this freezing hangar, and then sending your instrument off into the sky on this huge balloon. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, really romantic and exciting. And I think it's, you know, another example, I suppose, of just how far people will go literally to the end of the Earth in order to find out more about the world.
Absolutely. And when I was reading that, I mean, it really felt like science fiction almost, that the scenes seemed otherworldly. And as you say, an amazing sign of how dedicated some scientists are to finding out how the world works. Harry, thank you so much for talking about your book and explaining space oddities and anomalies. It's been fascinating and a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, likewise. Thanks. Nice to talk to you, Alex.
That was Harry Cliff, author of Space Oddities, available now at a bookstore near you. I've been Alex Wilkins. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.